We are approaching the top of the hour, so at this time, I do want to take the opportunity to introduce our speakers. We're very, very grateful for them joining us today. Speaking first, we have Dr. Catherine Hoggett. She is the Research Health Scientist and Career Development Awardee for the VA HSR&D Center for the Study of Healthcare Innovation, Implementation, and Policy at the VA Greater Los Angeles Healthcare System, and also an Adjunct Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Speaking second today, we have Dr. Tracy Simpson. She works at the Center of Excellence in Substance Abuse Treatment and Education at the VA Puget Sound Healthcare System and is also an associate professor in the University of Washington School of Medicine. And at this time, I'd like to check. Catherine, are you ready to share your screen?
I am.
Excellent. You should have that pop up now.
All right. Can you guys see it okay?
We are good to go.
All right. Should we wait another minute or so before starting, or should we get started?
Well, I'm kind of a stickler. I like to get started, but if you want to wait.
No. I'm fine with that. It'll leave more time at the end, potentially, for questions. So thanks for that introduction, Molly. As Molly said, Tracy and I are here to talk to you today about alcohol and drug use, abuse, and dependence among women veterans. So first, we're going to start off with a poll question to get a sense of who's in our audience. Molly, did you want to take this away?
Sure. So as our attendees can see, you do have a poll question open on your screen at this time. Just click the circle next to your response. You can click the circle right on your screen. And as you can see, we're trying to figure out your primary role in VA. I know many of you wear different hats within VA, but we're looking for you to answer just your primary role. Those answer options are clinician, researcher, administrator, other, or non-VA. And for those of you clicking other, please note that at the end of the session, when we put up the feedback survey, there will be a more extensive list of roles, so you may be able to find your exact position listed there. And we've got a nice responsive audience. We're approaching 80% response rate, so we'll give people just a few more seconds to get their answers in. Okay, we've got over 80% response rate. That's great. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll out and share the results. So as you can see on your screen, we have just about a third of the audience each are clinicians and researchers. We have about 13% administrators, 14% responding other, and 5% of our audience joining us today is non-VA, so we'd like to welcome them as well. And with that, Catherine, I will turn it back over to you now.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like we're pretty evenly divided by clinicians and researchers, and with some administrators, others, and non-VA. So I hope that we'll have something for each of you in our talk today. Before we get started with some of the empirical results we'd like to discuss, I wanted to go over a few definitions of the terms we're going to be using in the course of our presentation. I'm then going to walk you through some of the existing research findings on the epidemiology of substance use disorder and alcohol misuse among women veterans, including a discussion on what we know about the rates of comorbid conditions among women veterans with and without substance misuse. We're going to talk a little bit about how alcohol screening is done in VA and the implications of the choice of alcohol screening instrument and the thresholds that are used to determine alcohol misuse. Then I'm going to hand it over to Tracy, who's going to talk about women's sub-treatment, including a discussion of the program that she's affiliated with up in Seattle, the VA Puget Sound Women's Addiction Program. And then we're going to talk about alternative venues for addressing women veterans' sub-related health concerns. So to start off with, by substance use disorder, what we're going to be referring to here is abuse of or dependence on alcohol or other drugs, excluding tobacco. Substance use disorder includes both alcohol use disorder and substance-specific drug use disorders. The diagnostic criteria for these conditions are detailed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Some of you are probably familiar with this. The standard currently in use still is the DSM-4, although, as many of you know, there's a transition going on to implement the criteria and definitions of the DSM-5. And that has implications in particular for substance use disorder, although I'm not going to go into that in today's talk. For the studies that we discuss that use diagnosis codes from electronic health records, the standard that's used there is the ICD-9 definition. Now, as many of you know, DSM-4 diagnoses can be mapped to ICD-9 codes, the codes that are typically used for billing and documentation in the electronic health record, but it's not a one-to-one correspondence. When we talk about alcohol misuse today, what we're talking about is a spectrum of unhealthy alcohol use that ranges from risky drinking to diagnostic criteria concordant AUD. As many of you know, VA screens for alcohol misuse using an instrument called the AUDIT-C. The AUDIT-C includes the first three questions of the World Health Organization's AUDIT instrument. And importantly, these questions focus on consumption, but not symptoms of dependence or consequences of drinking. One thing that I wanted to discuss, because there was a great figure that illustrates these concepts in an article by Frank et al. From 2008, is that alcohol use can be conceptualized as a spectrum from drinking within recommended limits to more severe disorders like alcohol abuse or dependence. Alcohol misuse includes the portion of the spectrum from risky drinking all the way through alcohol use disorders. We're also going to talk very briefly about hazardous or harmful alcohol use. This is what's assessed with the full 10-item audit, and this includes hazardous use or alcohol misuse, drinking above recommended limits. It also assesses symptoms of alcohol dependence, and it assesses harmful alcohol use, which is related to consequences of drinking. We're going to summarize some findings from studies that have considered binge, or to use the preferred term, heavy episodic drinking. The way that binge or heavy episodic drinking is defined varies quite a bit from study to study. Often, the criteria for a single binge episode is operationalized in terms of NIAAA thresholds for unhealthy or hazardous use, which is 4 or more drinks on occasion for women or 5 or more drinks on occasion for men. Binge or heavy episodic drinking can be assessed over the past month or past year. And the audit C includes a question that assesses binge drinking. However, the threshold used on the third item of the standard audit C has a threshold of 6 or more drinks, which, as you'll see, is higher than the threshold that NIAAA recommends for either women or men. Now, I will use periodically the term substance misuse. And what I mean by substance misuse, this is not a well-defined term outside of this talk, but what that's meant to convey is alcohol or drug, non-tobacco, misuse, abuse, or dependence. So it's kind of a catch-all term. For those of you who haven't seen it before, this is the VA screening tool, the AUDIT-C. As you'll see, it consists of 3 questions focused on consumption. You'll see how the AUDIT-C is scored here. And as I pointed out on the previous slide, question 3 assesses binge drinking with a threshold of 6 or more drinks on occasion. So together with colleagues from the Women's Health Research Network SUD work group, Tracy and I worked on a systematic review of the literature on substance misuse in women veterans, and that was published earlier this year in Epidemiologic Reviews. And based on the findings from this literature review, the proportion of women VA patients who screen positive for alcohol misuse ranges from 12% to 37%, when the cut point used is a gender-specific recommended threshold of 3+ on the audit C. Using the VA's threshold of 5 or more drinks on the audit C, which is the threshold at which a clinical reminder is triggered for brief intervention, and it's also the threshold at which a performance measure tracks the delivery of brief intervention to veteran patients with alcohol misuse, the proportion screening positive is 4% to 17%, and looking at hazardous or harmful drinking assessed with the audit, looking at an audit threshold of 8 or more, the proportion of women veterans with hazardous or harmful drinking ranges from 4 to 23%. A number of studies that have examined diagnosed alcohol use disorder, drug use disorder, or substance use disorder examined rates of these diagnoses documented in the electronic health record among VA patients. Looking at results from recently published studies from about 1999 onward, rates of alcohol use disorder. And again, this represents the more severe end of the unhealthy alcohol use spectrum, ranges from 3 to 10%. The rates of drug use disorder in women VA patients ranges from 1 to 6%. And substance use disorder, which means presence of a diagnosis consistent with AUD or DUD, ranges from 3 to 16%. Now, you'll notice that there is a considerable range in these estimates, and as you can see if you look at the online supplement from that Epidemiologic Reviews article, the rates that are reported are highly dependent on the individual sampled in a given study, whether it's psychiatric inpatients, outpatients, what age groups are included, what areas of service are included, and so forth. Now, there is limited information comparing women veterans and non-veterans that use publicly available data sources. So women veterans here, by women veterans here, I mean possibly VA patients, but these studies haven't exclusively focused on VA patients, and they haven't reported separate estimates for VA patients. So these are general comparisons between women veterans and non-veterans. Now, as this slide shows, there's been little replication across studies, in part because the definitions of the drinking outcomes have varied. If you look at the details of these definitions, what you can see is that because of differences in the groups studied, the data sources, and the definitions used, these aren't actually comparable. However, one central take-home point here, and this isn't stated explicitly on the slide, is that when these studies made statistical comparisons between veterans and non-veterans, they did not find a statistical difference between the two groups. What this means is that when they conducted chi-square tests or a t-test looking for differences between veterans and non-veterans, the p-values that were found were greater than the conventional cut point for statistical significance of 0.05. Now, Tracy and I have also done work with colleagues to examine substance misuse prevalence in women veterans and non-veterans using data from the National Surveys on Drug Use and Health, and these data were pooled between 2002 and 2010. We analyzed a number of different substance misuse outcomes, but what I'm presenting here is just one set of analyses for DSM-IV concordant substance use disorder. Now, what you'll see here is that there's little consistent difference between women veterans and non-veterans. When we tested for differences, all of the p-values comparing veterans and veterans were greater than 0.05. There's a suggestion, if you look at the point estimates, that there may be some difference in the patterns between veterans and non-veterans across age groups. Again, however, that there wasn't a statistical difference. One other study has compared veterans and non-veterans using data on women 50 years of age and older from the Women's Health Initiative. This is work that was recently completed by Tracy and colleagues and has been submitted to the gerontologist. In this analysis, the only comparison that yielded a statistical difference or a p-value less than 0.05 was the comparison of the proportion of veterans and non-veterans who were lifetime abstainers. Another comparison that we were interested in making, and we discussed this in the review, is the comparison in subprevalence between women veterans and men veterans. Now, across the studies that we examined, men consistently have higher rates of substance misuse than women do when a common definition is used. In some studies, the definition of the substance misuse outcome was gender-tailored, and in those studies, the rates between women and men were more comparable, as you would expect. However, when a common definition was used, men's rates were consistently higher, and to give you just one example, when we examined studies that had reported rates of diagnosed AUD in women veterans and men veterans, rates of AUD in men were about 1.5 to 3 times the rates for women. However, few of the studies that we found in our systematic review actually made direct comparisons of women and men veterans. So in further analyses using the NSVUH data, Tracy and I and colleagues also estimated SUD prevalence in women veterans and men veterans in the general population, and those results are summarized here. These differences, and we conducted statistical tests comparing women veterans and men veterans, all had p-values less than 0.05, and as you'll see, across age groups and overall, men veterans had higher SUD prevalence. there haven't been many studies that have compared women veterans who do and do not use VA care. In fact, the only study I know of to date that's examined substance misuse in women VA users and non-users explicitly used data from Donna Washington's National Survey of Women Veterans that was published earlier this year in the Journal of Substance Abuse Treatment. In this study, survey respondents were given an audit fee with a gender-tailored binge drinking question, which means that that third question of the audit fee used a threshold of 4 or more drinks on occasion rather than a threshold of 6 or more drinks on occasion. And in this study, we estimated the proportion of VA users and non-users with alcohol misuse overall and with moderate to severe alcohol misuse. Now, if you'd asked me going into this analysis which group I thought had higher rates of alcohol misuse, I would have said VA users. However, that isn't consistent with what we found when we looked at the data. In our analysis, looking at overall alcohol misuse using a gender-specific audit fee with a threshold of 3 or more, the rates of alcohol misuse for VA non-users were 32% versus 27% in VA users. And that was a statistical difference. The p-value from the chi-squared test was 0.05. However, when we looked at moderate to severe misuse, there wasn't a difference between VA users and non-users. What this means is that the difference that we found between VA non-users and users was driven primarily by differences in the rates of mild alcohol misuse. Now, because no studies have examined other types of substance misuse in women VA users and non-users, we also compared SUD prevalence rates using the NSVUH data to documented SUD diagnosis rates in women VA patients. Now, I want to note that this is not exactly a comparison of VA users and non-users because, of course, women veterans in the general population may include some VA patients, and we don't have the ability to determine that using the NSVUH data. What's interesting, however, in examining these rates, if you look in particular at the age group 18 to 25, is that the SUD prevalence rates obtained from nationally representative estimates for women veterans are considerably higher than the documented SUD diagnosis rates among VA patients. However, this pattern, the difference between women veterans and women VA patients, changes across age groups. And overall, if you look at that last set of bars, there's little difference between women patients and women VA patients. I'm going to come back around to what the implications of that finding for the youngest age group are at the end of my section. In our systematic review, we also examined comorbidities reported among women veterans with and without substance misuse. Previous studies have reported that relative to women veterans without substance misuse, those with misuse generally had higher rates of trauma exposures, psychiatric comorbidities, some medical comorbidities, and among VA patients, higher mortality and suicide rates. The detailed results from our analysis of the National Survey of Women Veterans, if you look at the online supplement to that article, we also have some details looking at rates of alcohol misuse and the correlation with other co-occurring conditions and a history of trauma, for those of you who are interested. Now, how we screen for alcohol misuse in VA has implications for whether or not we're effectively detecting women veterans with alcohol misuse. As I mentioned before, a score of 3 or more is a recommended gender-specific threshold for a positive screen for women, and this is based on validation studies that were conducted by Kathy Bradley and colleagues using a sample of women veterans. However, in VA, it's a score of 5 or greater that triggers a clinical reminder for brief intervention, and that's tracked with the VA performance measure. So the one question that comes out of this work is whether VA is effectively identifying women veterans with alcohol misuse. This understanding the difference in the proportion of women who are going to screen positive depending on the threshold used and depending on whether or not there's a gender-specific binge drinking question on the audit fee has not been examined directly. However, what we can determine is when we use an audit fee threshold of 3 or greater versus 5 or greater, it makes a difference, as you would expect, in the proportion of women who are screening positive. And if you play around with these numbers, the take-home point from this slide overall is that depending on whether we use a threshold of 3 or more, which is the gender-specific recommended threshold, or 5 or more, which is the VA's implemented threshold, we may be missing about 2/3 of women who actually have alcohol misuse by virtue of the use of a higher threshold for a positive score in VA. So the epidemiology of substance use disorder in women veterans, why does this matter? Well, one of the angles that we came to this work with was that there was considerable conventional wisdom that sometimes cited in articles looking at substance use disorder in women veterans, and we wanted to examine whether the conventional wisdom that substance misuse or SUD are more common in women veterans versus civilians or among VA users versus non-users is actually supported by the research evidence. And what we found is that while the conventional wisdom may be true, there's very little empirical support. Where direct comparisons have been made, there hasn't been a statistical difference between women veterans and civilians. And as I mentioned in our analysis of the National Survey of Women Veterans, when we looked at alcohol misuse, it was actually the VA non-users that had higher rates. This points out that there are important information gaps, including no estimates of true SUD prevalence for women VA patients. This is a concern, in particular, if you look back at this slide that compared women veterans in the general population to VA patients, because we have no way of determining whether women veterans with substance use disorder are being adequately identified and thereby referred to treatment. What we do know is that existing screening programs, do not address drug use and may disproportionately fail to detect women with alcohol misuse because of the lack of a gender-tailored instrument and the use of a higher threshold for a screen for positive alcohol misuse. The bottom line is that the system that is not accountable for delivering SUD care to patients it can't see. So existing data are suggestive but insufficient to detect whether and to what extent there are SUD case finding shortfalls and whether or to what extent there are gaps in access to SUD care. So, you know, it's the worst recommendation coming out of any talk or research article, but more research is needed in this case because, as we summarized, there's a lack of information in the published research literature to date. So with that, I would like to hand it back to Molly and Tracy for the second part of the presentation.
Thank you so much. So once again, we're going to have another poll question pop up for you, ladies and gentlemen. So please take just a moment and fill this out for us. So as you can see, the question is, do you provide care to women veterans with SUD? And the answer options are yes, in a specialty SUD care setting. Yes, I provide SUD-related treatment in a non-specialty SUD care setting, for instance, primary care, general mental health care, etc. No, I do not provide SUD-related treatment for women veterans with SUD. Or no, I am not a clinician. And it looks like people are starting to respond. We've had about a 75% response rate, so we'll give people a little more time. So once again, please just click the circle on your screen that best identifies your level of providing care or not to women veterans with SUD. Okay, it looks like we've capped off at 3/4 of our audience responding, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll, and I will share those results. Looks like 15% say yes, they do provide care in an SUD care setting. 23% say they do provide SUD-related treatment in a non-specialty SUD care setting. 26% do not provide SUD-related treatment for women veterans with SUD. And about a third of our audience, 36%, say, no, I am not a clinician. So thank you to those respondents. And at this time, Dr. Simpson, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Great. Let me click into my screen.
Okay. There we go.
Okay, wonderful. Great. Thank you, Molly and Catherine. This, I think, sets the stage nicely for talking some about treatment issues for women veterans with SUD. And oddly, in a way, I'm going to start in the civilian sector because there's actually quite a bit more research on women's SUD treatment in the civilian sector than there is in VA. So I think to provide some background and context, we'll hopefully learn some things from what's been learned among civilian folks. And what we see in the civilian literature is that fewer women who have an SUD than men who have an SUD enter SUD care. So among those with substance use problems or substance use disorders, women are less likely to enter alcohol or drug care. In addition, women have different referral patterns. So women are more likely to be referred for SUD care by social service agencies, and they are less likely than men to be referred to SUD care through the courts or criminal justice. And then once in treatment, women tend to do about as well as men, which is some very good news, obviously. And predictors of success for both genders are greater financial resources, fewer mental health problems, and less severe drug problems. And then predictors of success, particularly for women, are greater social stability, greater social support, less anger, and a greater belief in the efficacy of treatment. And these findings should not be surprising to anyone. Folks who are more stable, who've got more resources, more support, are generally going to be able to take advantage of treatment options and opportunities better than people whose lives are pretty chaotic and they're really struggling. To set the stage, it seemed important to make sure everybody was aware of these basic findings. And one of the phrases that gets thrown around or tossed around when we're talking about women's care in SUD is the idea of gender-sensitive care. And so I thought it would be a good idea to talk just a minute about what that is. And essentially, gender-sensitive care addresses the kinds of issues that certainly could be relevant for men, but are almost certainly going to be relevant for a large proportion of women with SUD. And those have to do with children, pregnancy, parenting, custody issues, regaining custody, losing custody, those kinds of very, very big deals that can happen for people with SUD problems. Domestic violence, current sexual and physical victimization, and also childhood histories of those issues, psychiatric comorbidities, and then housing and income support can also need to be addressed in the context of gender-sensitive care. Now, it's not imperative that gender-sensitive care be delivered in a women-only setting or in women-only groups. It can be done in co-ed settings. So just to keep that in mind, we're going to spend quite a bit of time in the next few slides on the issue of women-only settings versus mixed gender, but I just want you to know that gender-sensitive care can happen in any sort of mix of gender context for treatment. So I think that within VA, this question of whether women-only groups matter is quite important, and we'll get to some of why within VA this is so crucial. But first, want to review some information from the civilian literature again, where people have compared in research settings mixed gender versus women-only intervention studies or interventions. And overall, the results are fairly mixed, where some studies are showing that women-only interventions people do better with treatment engagement, retention, outcomes. And in other studies, they're not showing much difference between mixed gender and women-only intervention contexts. The more recent studies, and I've listed some of them there on the left, are finding, however, that women-only settings, the women tend to do better as far as retention and their SUD outcomes. And there's pretty convincing evidence that women with more psychological distress or who don't feel very good about themselves have better outcomes if they're in a women-only setting versus a mixed-gender setting. And there's some really lovely qualitative work that Shelley Greenfield did where she interviewed her participants who were randomized to receive women-only versus mixed-gender care. And I just quickly want to go through what the women said about what it was like to be in their groups. And she divided it out in a number of different ways, but talked about the group atmosphere, the style of communication and the topics that were covered, and then how the women felt about themselves. In terms of the group atmosphere, for women in the women-only group, they tended to say that they felt like their needs were met, that they shared a language and a sense of understanding and intimacy, emotional intimacy with the other women in their groups. For those in the mixed gender group, they tended to say that while they could identify with the other women and that they felt like the group atmosphere held them accountable as far as their alcohol and drug goals, that they really felt like they couldn't talk about negative feelings, there was a lack of empathy, and there was a sense of sexual tension in the room. In terms of communication styles and the topics that the women in groups felt that they could cover or how the communication went, they said that the people in their groups were willing to take risks, there was more emotion in the room, and it felt like there was more honesty and comfort and empathy in the communication styles, and that they could talk about relationships, what it was like to be an addicted woman, being in a caretaker role, so things that were relevant to women. In the mixed gender setting, the communication styles or communication dynamics, I guess, were such that the women were more active, the men were often silent, and the women felt that they needed to be prompting the men to talk. The women felt that they needed to engage in kind of a filtered communication, so sort of censoring themselves. And they did say that they felt like they were able to learn more about the other gender. As far as topics, they said that gender-neutral topics were okay, and that the women tended to tell stories, and I think that kind of ties back with the women being more active. And they also had the sense that there was quite a bit of irrelevant talk in terms of SUD treatment and recovery, that there was kind of a lot of excess verbiage that wasn't on point. And then in terms of self-perceptions, the folks in the women-only groups said that they felt like they could be their entire selves, that they felt safe, they could be honest and really reveal who they were in the context of their group treatment. The women in the mixed gender groups felt that they needed to be polite, they needed to be different from themselves and kind of constrained and guarded, and they felt actually, some of them reported feeling stigmatized and like they were kind of bringing their shameful selves to the group context. And at this point, this is all based on civilian women in the community, and we don't yet have published qualitative work from women veterans, but pretty soon that's going to change. Eleanor Lewis and Mike Couchier have a study that they are actively working on, and I know Allison Hamilton has some data, and then we have some data here at the Puget Sound that we're working on. So hopefully soon we'll have some qualitative information available that we can share about that women vets are talking about their SUD experiences, both as addicted women and in terms of treatment. But moving on, it just so happened that in August, just last month, our largest addiction treatment care team did a satisfaction survey, and one of the questions in that survey was asking the patients how willing they would be to attend a mixed gender group. And we just had a handful of women respond to the survey and a lot more men. As you can see, we had 19 women and 171 men. And the women said, about half of them said that yes, they'd be willing to, and then the other half were either no or, well, maybe. And for the men, 76% said that yes, they'd be willing to do a mixed gender group, and then the rest were either equivocal or saying no. And so that's, you know, it's not published data. It's never going to be published data, but it's a nice sort of snapshot as far as sort of the greater hesitation, I think, on the part of the women vets than on the part of the men vets to participate in mixed gender groups. So I've borrowed a little bit from the 2008 VA Uniform Mental Health Services package to just bring home the point that VA is very committed to providing the mental health services that female veterans need at a level equivalent to their male counterparts. And the idea here is that clinicians really need to possess the training and competencies to meet the unique mental health needs of women veterans. And I think some of what Catherine covered earlier on comorbidities touches on that and is quite important, obviously, that at every facility people be ready and able to meet the needs of the women vets. And how this happens from facility to facility is pretty variable, as, you know, probably no surprise. And I just want to share a little bit of information from the VA's Drug and Alcohol Program Survey. And this is a survey that goes out every 2 years to all the facilities in the field. And one of the questions historically has been whether each addiction care line offers any women-specific groups or other services specifically geared to women. And before the Uniform Mental Health Package came online in 2008, about 30%, in 2006, about 30% of facilities offered this kind of care. 2008 was a little bit higher. 2010 so far was the high point at 60%, and then in 2012 it backed off to about 56%. And the 2014 data are being summarized, and I'll talk a little bit more about those data in just a second. Elizabeth Oliva at Palo Alto did a nice study using DAPS data from 2008 along with VA patient care data and found that about 33% of the 15,500 women with an SUD diagnosis had received some outpatient SUD care in that fiscal year in 2008, and that the factors predicting receipt of care were being between the ages of 31 and 55 and the presence of a comorbid psychiatric disorder. In addition, facilities that offered specialized women's SUD care were more likely to have women with SUD receiving SUD care, and those facilities that had a higher ratio of mental health providers and prescribers to patients. So those were 2008 data. As I mentioned a minute ago, in the DAPS, the Drug and Alcohol Program Survey, data from 2014 also collected data about women's services and the women's research group, the VA's women's research SUD group was able to add several questions so that we can flesh out a bit what is being offered across the country. And so questions that we have in the survey are whether whether women vets at each of the facilities is being, it has available SUD-specific women-only group psychotherapy, SUD and PTSD-specific women-only group psychotherapy, so for example, seeking safety or cognitive processing therapy, whether there's available SUD-specific individual psychotherapy, and whether they offer SUD-specific mixed-gender group psychotherapy. And we'll be, the research group will be taking a look at those numbers and summarizing them and then also linking to the patient-level data so that we can get a sense of how women's care is being distributed and whether it seems to matter what facilities are offering. Okay. So in terms of some contextual factors that I think have treatment implications for women veterans with SUD, in general, women, as Catherine pointed out, women are less likely to have an SUD or to meet diagnostic criteria for an SUD than are men. And women are a minority of the overall veteran population. And so within the SUD context, women veterans with an SUD are going to be an extreme minority of the patients in VA SUD care clinics. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Also, women veterans with SUD tend to have high rates of comorbid psychiatric disorders and military sexual trauma. So for a woman veteran with SUD within VA, she can easily end up being one of one or one of two women in a VA SUD group. And if only one or two women are in a group of, say, 10 or 12 or 14 veterans, women's issues are not likely to be addressed. And for women with SUD and a history of MSD, it may be too hard to be in group with men. That could simply be too challenging. And the other thing that can happen for women is if they need inpatient detox or detoxification or extended inpatient care, they may not be willing to go if it means that they need to be in a setting with a lot of men and maybe one or two women, that it just may not feel safe. And what that ends up doing on the outpatient side is having providers handle providers and patients handle pretty extreme substance use problems in an outpatient setting, and there can be some challenges around that. And there are also challenges facing VA in terms of providing gender-sensitive care for women. So populating women-only outpatient groups within VA can really be challenging because of the low census of women. And typically, facilities that make that commitment to having women-only groups are going to need to be willing to support small groups because of numbers. And then within inpatient settings, there are the additional challenges of needing to ensure physical safety, some sense of privacy, and also, and this is relevant in an outpatient setting as well, but emotional safety is important. And again, expertise regarding women's issues, MST, and psychiatric comorbidities is going to be imperative in both outpatient and inpatient settings. And then there is the important thing to keep in mind that some women veterans actually prefer mixed gender groups. Just anecdotally, we have quite a handful of women whose primary traumas were combat related and not MST, and they've not had any sexual violence. And a lot of those women actually prefer to be in mixed gender groups. And so for VA, balancing both women-only offerings, if possible, and then mixed-gender groups can be somewhat challenging. So I want to give you a quick overview of what we've been doing here in Seattle and some of the shifts that have happened over the years, just as a sort of a case example of how gender-sensitive care can be fashioned and the kind of the different clinic structures that can still support gender-sensitive care. So back in 1993, some of the providers here started offering a couple of women-only groups, and they were holding monthly care coordination meetings for the providers that were sort of drop-in, come if you can. And then in 2000, the Women's Addiction Treatment Clinic was actually designated as a team within the Addiction Care Line. And then in 2005, the Women's ATC merged with our Women's Trauma Program, and what we did is formed a Women's Trauma and Recovery Center. And that was operational until 2014, when Women's Addiction Programming was brought back under the General Addictions Team within the Addiction Treatment Care Line. And let me give you a little bit of, and these are just my ideas about pros and cons of these two different clinic structures. When, for the WTRC team, when we had the combined addiction and trauma program, the pros of that were that we had pretty fluid case coordination for the women. There were easy transitions for them to go from addiction care to trauma care or vice versa, and they didn't need to transfer providers or be referred to a different clinic or go to a different building. And there was fairly cohesive program, quite cohesive program planning. In terms of cons of that model, there were only a few providers seeing most of the women. The team was pretty isolated from the main clinics, and there were ongoing challenges with securing psychiatrist time. And then since 2014, with the integration into the larger addiction treatment clinic, the pros have been that there are more providers to see women, there's reliable availability of psychiatry time, and the women's care is integrated into the workings of the larger clinic, which has been nice, and we have been able to retain women-only group offerings. Some of the challenges with this new, well, for us, new structure, there is still the risk of one provider essentially being tagged it for seeing most of the women. If somebody is seen as a specialized, and we do have this, there is a single person who is seen as a specialized person who sees, who has expertise about women. Women's care, there is the risk that that person could just be tagged it. There are also some program planning challenges for making sure that women's needs are met in the context of the larger team. And the co-ed groups are still likely to have only one or two women. And so I'm kind of making a distinction between co-ed groups and mixed gender groups because the studies, the earlier studies in the civilian context, when they were looking at mixed gender, what they had a fairly even distribution of men and women and not just one or two women. And it's a very different experience, I think, for somebody to be one of only one or two women in a group. And in terms of what we offer, we are able to have women veterans coming in for services do their initial assessment with a woman, and I think that's probably fairly standard across the VA. So if they choose to see a woman, they can do it at that point. They can also choose to be in a mixed gender group or a women-only group or both, and that can be either through the Addiction Treatment Center, or we do have some crossover groups within the mental health clinic where women can be seen as well. And as far as our initial of women-only stabilization services, and those tend to be for the first 3 to 6 months, we have a DBT-oriented skills group, a relapse prevention group, harm reduction group, and then individual case management and psychiatric medication. And then for those women who have established some sobriety and stability, they can attend a women-only weekly continuing care group, and they can negotiate the attendance frequency. And then our harm reduction group actually functions both as an initial stabilization and a continuing care, depending where a woman is. And then, again, there would be continuing case management and psychiatric medication for women as they are progressing in their recovery and they're stable in their abstinence. So in terms of numbers, we pulled some numbers from fiscal year 2014 just to give you a sense of our census here in Seattle. And I am making a distinction. VA Puget Sound is actually Seattle and the American Lake VA. And so I've isolated Seattle because our programs are somewhat different across the two campuses. But in 2014, we had 279 women veterans with a documented SUD out of the over 8,000 women. So we have about a rate of about 3.3%. And of those 279, 105 of them, or 37% or so, had one or more SUD care stop codes in fiscal year 2014. Currently, we have 59 women actively enrolled in SUD specialty care. Most of those are in the general addiction care clinic, and all but three of them are enrolled in at least one women-only group. And then we also have 13 women in our opiate treatment program. And the accommodations that that treatment or that program has been able to make is that they will provide dosing at different times than the men if the women prefer that, and the women in that program can participate in women-only groups through the general addiction care line. Okay. So as you can tell, there are an awful lot of women with SUD, a lot of women vets with SUD who are not getting specialty care, and that's probably not a big surprise. And again, I have borrowed actually verbatim from the Uniform Mental Health Services Package from 2008 to talk just a little bit about when treatment is refused and SUD problems are persisting. And I borrowed it verbatim because I think they just did a wonderful job of laying out what providers need to be doing in primary care and other non-SUD mental health care clinics to keep the conversation alive with women patients and men patients who may be ambivalent about going to specialty care for their substance use problems. They may not feel they need specialty care, but keeping that conversation open and alive is important for a lot of reasons. And so there's some ideas here about how that can happen. And one would be asking women to monitor their substance use, continuing to check in about whether they might accept referrals to specialty SUD care, because just because someone said no a year ago or 6 months ago doesn't mean they might not be ready now. And enhancing motivation to change through a variety of different tactics, including providing some information, having them identify problems that alcohol or drugs might have caused, and generally having frequent appointments with them, which obviously can be challenging, but for folks with ongoing SUD, keeping a closer eye on them is a good idea. And then infusing all of those interactions with a high degree of empathy and understanding, and keeping the judgment and the labels out of the conversation. So in terms of kind of pulling it all together, I think that we're all more or less well we're all actually quite a bit more and not less in this together, and so if we all do our parts, hopefully we can be doing a better job of identifying women veterans with SUD or at risk substance use. I think that there are going to be some really interesting questions and opportunities for figuring out what are best practices for women with SUD within a VA context, and perhaps learning from some of what's been done in the civilian context to inform that. I think we also have the challenge of helping facilities optimize their SUD care for women within their practical constraints, because there really are some practical constraints that we have to take into consideration. And that the goal here is that we as a whole help women veterans with SUD feel valued as veterans, as women, that they recognize that they're not alone and they're not misfits or outliers, and that they get the treatment that they need in contexts where they feel understood and respected and have a chance to contribute in ways that feel meaningful to them. So with that, we want to thank you. And if you would like to contact either myself or Catherine, we've got our email addresses there. We're also in Outlook. And we want to thank the folks who gave Catherine her CDA. We're thrilled that that happened. And her SED query grant. And then the Women's Health Research Network has been a great support, and the Program Evaluation Center and the Mental Health Services and our operations partners there and SED query. And then at the very end here, we've got a slew of references for you in case you want to follow up on anything that we cited. And that's it.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. So for our attendees, yeah, this is the opportunity to have any Q&A with the presenters. I know a lot of you joined us after the top of the hour, so to submit your question, please use the question section of the GoToWebinar control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Just click the plus sign next to the word questions. That will open the dialog box. You can then submit your question or comment and press submit, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. And we'll go ahead and kick off. Is there any data available related to pharmacological interventions such as vivitrol and their efficacy?
To clarify, I'm guessing that this means whether there's any evidence for different efficacy among women or overall efficacy.
We can roll with that. They can write in for clarification if
they need. Tracy, you want to take that?
Sure. Unfortunately, I don't know the data offhand on Vivitrol, but there, overall, I know that it's been found to be quite useful for people. And I can drill down and send Molly some details about women. There are some pharmacological studies that have looked at gender differences in terms of response, but I don't want to misquote them, so I will pull that together and make it available to Molly, who can then pass it along.
Not a problem at all. I'll be happy to attach it to the handouts if you'd like in the archive.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Okay.
And Tracy, can you back it up to your contact info slide?
Yes.
Just want to give people the opportunity to take that down if they have to leave.
Yeah.
Thanks. The person writes in for clarification, I was just wondering if it is included in treatment plan as psychotherapy was the intervention cited.
Pardon? Can you say that again?
They were just wondering if it is included in the treatment plan as psychotherapy was the intervention cited. So I think they want to know if a pharmacological intervention was part of the treatment plan as well.
Oh, I see. As far as the studies that we're looking at mixed gender and women only groups, perhaps, or certainly at the Seattle VA, pharmacology or pharmacotherapy is included in treatment plans. Yes, I actually don't know whether in the studies that have looked at women only versus mixed gender groups, what they were doing as far as pharmacotherapy. I would be surprised if there was anything systematic about it in those studies. But I can take a look and see. I imagine what they did is they held, they required that people be stable on their medications before they came into the studies. But I'll check that.
Thank you. That person writes in, perfect. Thank you. So it sounds like you hit the nail on the head for responding.
Okay, good. All right.
The next question, was there any unique demographic characteristics that would point to military service, enlisted or officer branch, as the main stressor for SUD versus other factors such as parental, employment, marital status, et cetera? So I think they want to know.
In terms of determinants of SUD or in terms of determinants of treatment success?
I think in determinants of SUD, it says as the main stressor for SUD.
Sure. So the studies that I've looked at to date haven't had that kind of granular information on veteran-specific characteristics. So I haven't seen studies that have specifically looked at the role of rank within military settings and the implications for that on women veterans' rates of SUD. I think it's a great question, and I think that to date the data just haven't been collected to allow us to address that.
Yeah, and I think we'd also want to look at family history of substance use disorders and the sort of the usual things that are factors in predicting whether somebody develops an SUD and seeing whether above and beyond those typical factors some of the military stressors that women might encounter or protective factors and officer versus enlistment status would perhaps be a risk or a protective factor, whether those add any information above and beyond what we would know from the basics like family history. And but that's a great question. That would be really interesting to know the answer to.
The person writes in, maybe one day. Thank you.
Right. Indeed.
The next question, do you know how many of the women veterans with SUD diagnoses were also MST survivors?
With SUD diagnoses, what I can tell you is that MST has been, so for the studies that have looked at women VA patients, we have estimates of the co-occurrence between SUD and MST, and I certainly have those figures available, not in front of me, but if someone wants to email me, I can tell you what we know about that. The studies of women veterans in the general population don't have that kind of information, so that's a big question mark. So a lot of what we know about that co-occurrence is limited to what's been reported or what's been studied for women VA patients.
Thank you.
And I will say the one study that I know of that has actually looked at that for women VA users and non-users is the National Survey of Women Veterans. And there we were looking at alcohol misuse, not substance use disorder as a whole.
Thank you for that reply. And if I'm not mistaken, we did a cyber seminar on that. Becky Ono presented for the Women's Health Cyber Seminar Series, so feel free to hit our online archive catalog and search by that series. That is the final pending question. There's a lot of people that wrote in saying thank you for the great presentation. I would like to give each of you ladies an opportunity to make any concluding comments if you'd like to, in no specific order. Catherine, if you'd like to say anything.
Sure. I just wanted to say that we definitely want to keep this dialogue going with people in VA who are interested in veterans with SUD and women veterans SUD treatment. So please feel free to contact us. We both have ongoing work in this area. The Women's Health Research Network SUD work group has a very vibrant collaboration going. So for those of you who are interested, you can get in touch with us if you'd like to join that. But otherwise, if you have other questions or thoughts, or you'd like to get involved, please feel free to contact us.
Yeah. I think Catherine summed it up very nicely. I'm really appreciative of this opportunity and so glad so many of you called in and participated in this interesting way of sharing information.
Collaboration in the new era.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, ladies, so much for lending your expertise to the field and for the great presentation. And thank you, of course, to our attendees for joining us. We have recorded today's presentation, and you'll receive a follow-up email with a link leading to it so you can pass that along to your colleagues. I'm going to close out the session in just a second, so please wait just a moment while the feedback survey populates on your screen. It's just a few questions, getting some feedback, but we do look very closely at your responses. It helps our presenters to improve the presentations they've given, as well as provides CIDR with new ideas for sessions to support. So thank you once again to everyone, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar presentation. Have a great day.